This is BTO, Beyond the Obvious 2.0, Germany's economics podcast with Daniel Stetter.
Hello and a very warm welcome to my show. My name is Daniel Stelter and I'm producing a weekly podcast on economic issues in Germany called Beyond the Obvious. From time to time, I have the honor and the pleasure of having English-speaking guests. If this is the case, I, of course, produce my usual German language podcast, but I also publish a special edition, which is basically the interview in original English, like today, where I had the great pleasure of having Barry Eichengreen of the University of California in Berkeley as a guest to discuss with him his thesis around public debt. After all, he has written a book called In Defense of Public Debt. So, here we go.
BTO, Beyond the Obvious 2.0.
Professor Eichengreen, a very warm welcome to my podcast.
Good to be here.
Professor Eichengreen, you just published a book with colleagues called In Defense of Public Debt. And as you know, I'm calling you from Germany, and the Germans, we are not so really keen on public debts. You know, we had the so-called Black Zero, and we were proud of having low debt levels, and we were committed after Corona to go back as quick as possible to balance budgets. Now we've got a war, but I think even now we are saying, well, at latest 2023, we have a balanced budget. So what's wrong about the Germans?
Well, Germany has a history. And Germans look back, not unreasonably, to the 1920s when foreign indebtedness in particular, was a factor in the high inflation in 1922-23. That had a searing effect on attitudes and outlooks. That experience is taught in German schools, all of which is appropriate, but it leads to a fixation on the dangers of debt. So that there are many worthwhile public institutions that also have dangers. Countries have armies. They have weapons. Recent experience reminds us why, but there are dangers associated with mobilizing them and deploying them. And the same is true of public debt. We wrote the book because we thought that dialogue in a variety of countries, not only Germany, but in the United States as well, was dominated by people who were aware, conscious of those dangers, but perhaps they downplayed or sometimes were oblivious to the utility of public debt, especially in emergencies. So we wrote the book before COVID. We started the book before COVID. We certainly completed and published the book before the war on Ukraine. But both COVID and the war are reminders that public debt is a valuable instrument of national defense, if you will, in emergencies.
Well, now the Germans would say, we are in a much better position to spend now more money and to take on more credit because we were so thrifty in the good times. And other countries, they have already much higher debt levels, if you look at France or Italy. So for them, it comes on top on a very high level. And for us, it comes on a lower debt level. Aren't we not in a better position because we have lower debt levels?
Absolutely. So Germans who say that are correct, that having fiscal space is valuable. But the reason having fiscal space is valuable is in order to use it when appropriate, when the need arises. The conclusion of our book, In Defense of Public Debt, is that prudent governments, when the time is right, will restore and enhance that fiscal space. I think that is true of my country, for example, the United States, where debt in the hands of the public is about 100% of GDP. As we speak, going forward, if there is another geopolitical emergency, climate-related disaster, something that requires government to issue debt and borrow, Germany will be in a more comfortable position than the U.S. And again, when the time is right, when economics and geopolitics settle down, I think some fiscal consolidation, reducing the debt ratio, would be appropriate for the U.S.
But you mentioned fiscal space. Could you probably define it? Because, you know, we have discussions in Europe. Let's take Italy. Italy has a debt level in the range of 160% of GDP. So where's the limit?
We've learned from history and from economic analyses that there's no magic number, that the limit depends on circumstances and economic conditions. Specifically, it depends on the evolution of two variables, the growth rate of the economy and the interest rate that has to be paid on the debt. The faster the economy grows, the faster you're increasing the country's capacity to service debt. You're raising the denominator of the debt to GDP ratio and making any nominal amount of public debt more comfortable because it's easier to service and repay out of growing government revenues. On the other hand, as the interest rate goes up, it becomes more expensive to roll over maturing debt and service outstanding obligations, especially if they are relatively short in term, short maturity debt, in other words. So in thinking about the limit, you have to have confidence in the clarity of your crystal ball. Do we know how fast our economies are going to grow going forward? Do we know how interest rates are going to evolve? So when the International Monetary Fund, for example, tries to answer that question, it provides a range of scenarios. And in the same way that central banks now produce fan charts for future inflation, kind of a range of possible outcomes, the IMF in its debt sustainability exercises provides a upside scenario, a downside scenario, a most likely scenario. And depending on how risk averse you are, you may want to attach more weight to the slow growth, high interest rate downside scenario.
My understanding is actually that normally governments don't pay back debts, but they are always refinancing it. And then if the economy grows, your debt to GDP ratio goes down. In your book, you mentioned the example of the United Kingdom after the Napoleonic Wars, where the growth rate was not high enough, and therefore the government had to run a primary surplus. And it worked. If you now look into Europe, many critics of the austerity policy point to Italy and say, well, Italy had a primary surplus for many years as well, but in the end it had higher debt than before because the growth rate didn't pick up. So, on austerity, is the growth effect of austerity in today's world too big that you cannot save yourself out of trouble?
No, I think saving oneself out of trouble and paying down the debt can be part of the solution, but I think only part. So the case you cite, Italy, really epitomizes the point that in terms of running budget surpluses, primary budget surpluses, Italy has done an admirable job while at the same time failing to reduce its debt to GDP ratio significantly because it hadn't solved the growth problem. And I think now going forward, simply running primary surpluses will not be enough to put Italy's public debt, which is on the order of 160% of GDP, on a sustainable footing. They need to grow the economy as well. And here people are hopeful that Mr. Draghi's reforms and more incentive to reform the Italian economy, make it more dynamic, make it more flexible in order to continue to obtain economic recovery program funds from the EU, will begin to solve that problem. Unfortunately, Italy is also very challenged demographically. So even if they grow per capita GDP over time, it's going to be hard for them to grow the number of capitas.
Actually, it's the same in Germany. And that's why I was a bit surprised that you said Germany is in a better position than the US, because the US still has a better demographics. But before we dive into more the aspects of how to deal with debt, I have to bring up what people call the modern, I'm sure you will disagree, but it's a modern monetary theory. And they would basically claim government debt doesn't matter because the government is basically creating the money by taking on the credit, which I think is technically correct. And therefore, they would say there's no need at all to pay back debt. Just look at Japan. You can have as much debt as you want.
Modern monetary theory is a little bit like an economist's Rorschach test. Different people look at it and they see different things. I read modern monetary theory as the assertion that central banks can buy as much public debt as they see fit and increase the money supply insofar as necessary in order to do so without inflationary consequences. And we've seen in the last 10 or so years that there are special circumstances where that's true. There was a lot of central bank purchasing of government bonds and money creation since the global financial crisis with minimal inflationary consequences in the advanced countries in particular. Economists refer to that as a liquidity trap situation. I think the flaw in modern monetary theory is they generalize that circumstance, that outcome, to all times and places. And we know there are other circumstances where interest rates are not becalmed around zero, where inflationary pressures intensify. And lo and behold, we're in one of those very different situations now as we speak, where as soon as modern monetary theory becomes fashionable, gains attention, if you will, the circumstance under which it's valid no longer applies.
Yes, as we speak about current situation, we had already inflation pick up before the war, but now given the war and given the sanctions, even if the war hopefully might be ended in a few weeks' time when we air the show, we still have an impact on raw material prices, on oil prices, and therefore on inflation. So I would interpret your words in the way of saying, well, governments have to be careful now with spending and with credit in such a circumstance if they don't want to have more inflation.
Governments have to be careful with spending. Central banks have to be careful with not falling further behind the curve.
Okay, basically what you say is if central banks are more restrictive, then what we have is the government spends and then other people don't spend as much and they have less combined demand in the economy.
In the United States, people have been warning that unemployment has fallen as low as it can fall, that capacity to produce is strained because of supply chain disruptions and the like, and that the additional deficit spending in March of 2021, the last Biden stimulus, was too much. It was inflationary. And I think we are seeing an accumulation of evidence that that's true. So to remind your listeners, the book is entitled In Defense of Public Debt, but that's not a license to issue additional public debt under all circumstances.
As we speak about the outlook now, I think we will face a more stagflationary scenario most probably in the coming years. If you now think about Europe, and I know you've been, I read and I hope it was correct that you have been a bit skeptical around the euro.
In fact, the opposite. So I've been thinking and writing about what became the euro since 1990, and for a long time, I was kind of the American who was convinced it would happen, as it did in 1999. Then in 2008, I right before the euro crisis, I was commissioned to write a piece for a conference volume on the euro, where my commission was to write about how the eurozone might break up. And my conclusion was that it couldn't and wouldn't happen because the costs of getting out would be so great. It would be hard to get out of the euro and stay in the European Union. Talking about getting out could provoke capital flight and the mother of all financial crises. And I think we've seen that view validated by what's happened in Greece, where if Greece didn't leave under the circumstances, the dire circumstances it faced, then no one's going to leave. Here in California, we like to say the euro is like Hotel California. You can check in, but you can't check out. I think there are structural problems with the euro. Some of them are on the way to solution. So nobody realized in 1999 that a monetary union without a banking union was problematic. But now considerable powers of bank regulation have been transferred to the European Central Bank. Capital markets union is still a work in progress. And there is a little bit of transfer of fiscal powers as a result of the pandemic to the European Commission, to the EU level. But, you know, the euro area is still a monetary union without a fiscal union. Labor mobility is still lower in Europe than it is in the United States. So the euro area doesn't work as smoothly as the dollar area. I'm a skeptic in that respect, but I'm convinced that the euro is here to stay.
And in order to stay, and coming back to the public debt issue, in your view, does it play a role that the public debt levels are so different given the members of the eurozone? So Germany being around 80, France 140, Italy 180, probably soon. So Greece very high. Does it matter, or do you say in the end it doesn't matter?
The concern of the architects of the euro when they put these reference values into the Maastricht Treaty in 1992, that debts should not exceed 60% of GDP or should converge toward 60% of GDP. The concern then was that if there were some heavily indebted member states in the euro area, the ECB would feel pressure to support their bond markets and keep interest rates low, and that would be inflationary. We haven't seen that kind of inflation in Europe up until now. So even though Greece and Italy and some others have not heavy debts that far exceed as a share of GDP what you see in Northern Europe, that hasn't translated into irresistible pressure on the ECB to inflate. That could, you know, it clearly the debt situation in Italy and Greece will complicate the ECB's efforts now to begin raising interest rates, which it's going to have to do. But will it hesitate for so long that inflationary pressure in Europe becomes persistent and irresistible? The history of the ECB suggests not, that they will make monetary policy with the eurozone as a whole and the 25% of the eurozone that Germany accounts for in mind.
Well, it's, you know, you could also say, well, like MMT is in fashion after an exceptional period, you could say the ECB had not been under pressure. It might also be just an exceptional period. We will see now going down the road when the inflation picks up what the ECB is doing. But if we are now thinking about how to deal with debt levels, because we spoke about, but first of all, you said basically government debt is good in circumstances, special circumstances, pandemic, war, whatever. You also said that it's good to, it would be wise to reduce government debt once these exceptional times are over. I think that would be the German approach. And we spoke about austerity, and austerity doesn't really work in Italy because lack of growth. So what other options would the Europeans or would every country have to deal with with government debt levels which are perceived to be too high?
Just to clarify a point, I think Italy's failure to grow is part of the problem in terms of achieving debt reduction, fiscal consolidation. But I would not blame that, attribute that inability to grow to austerity. I would attribute it to weak investment and structural rigidities and inefficient public administration, all those other familiar Italian problems. So I think that going forward, governments are going to be able to reduce their debt to GDP ratios. And again, it's relative to GDP that we should be measuring and thinking about how burdensome the public debt is by reducing the denominator of that ratio, the numerator of that ratio, the debt, through budget surpluses, and growing the denominator of that ratio through pro-growth policies. And I do think there is scope to grow the European economy through public-private partnerships that target the digital economy, target the green economy. High energy prices obviously are going to be a headwind, a challenge in the immediate future. But Europe is more serious than the United States about transitioning away from fossil fuels, about harnessing wind power and so forth. So I think there are high return investments to be made there.
And look, skeptics in Germany would say, well, the truth is that the ECB is going to support inflation because it's a true lever to grow the denominator, because then GDP goes also up, not because of real growth, but because of the valuation of money.
Yeah. So the question is whether the debt can be inflated away and whether inflation is going to be good or bad for debt consolidation. Right now, it's good for bringing down the debt ratio because inflation has gone up, but interest rates have not yet. But investors and others are going to catch on. And I think if inflation remains high, interest rates will catch up and rise potentially even more than inflation has risen, at which point inflation is counterproductive from the point of view of debt consolidation. So this is more of a problem in some countries than others. In the United Kingdom, the average maturity of the debt is 14 years. So only a little bit of that debt has to be rolled over and refinanced at higher interest rates every year. In the United States, on the other hand, the average maturity of the debt is only 5 years. So we are refinancing, rolling over a considerable fraction of our debt every year, potentially, depending on what now happens as a result of inflation, at higher interest rates. So the idea that we can simply inflate away the debt is premised on the notion that investors are stupid. And when it comes to inflation, I think they catch on.
So, no, and again, you know, if you're now going too far away from your book, please forgive me, but I have to ask this question, because if you assume interest rates go up, this has an issue for some debtors. You made a good point. By the way, Italy also has very long financed bonds. But it also has an implication on asset markets, because we would clearly say that the current valuation of stock markets or of real estate depends on low interest rates.
Yeah, so I that's clearly right. And one reason that central banks have been moving incrementally, gradually, in terms of what they call policy normalization, in other words, winding down asset purchase programs and beginning to raise interest rates, is they don't want to wrong foot or upset financial markets. So I think they will continue to move. I think central banks understand that a lot of what we've seen in financial markets is a consequence of having had low interest rates for a very long time. What's going to happen to Bitcoin prices when interest rates go up? They're almost certainly going to come down because with zero returns on a variety of other things, speculators have been looking around for something else to buy when keeping your money in the bank again begins to yield positive interest. I think those speculative investments will be less attractive. So that means that these high-risk markets, cryptocurrency is one example, emerging economies is another, are going to feel the pain inevitably, unavoidably, as rates go up in response to inflation.
And they're also going to feel the pain because the debt levels are high, also especially in US dollars. So as you speak about public debt, I would assume you are always proposing public debt in your own currency.
Well, in the book, we talk about public debt both in foreign currency, typically in dollars, and in the domestic currency. So if you look at emerging markets today, governments mainly borrow in their own currencies, but corporations, when they borrow externally in dollars. I had an incarnation in the 1990s where I worked on that subject in particular and suggested that foreign currency denominated debt was especially risky because the cost of servicing it depended on what the Fed did, what the dollar did, which was out of the control of local authorities in other countries, and they would be advised to try to develop financial markets at home where debt was denominated in their own currencies. And a number of countries have moved in that direction. As I said before, quite a few emerging markets are now able to issue debt denominated in their own currency. But what we've discovered is that when the Fed begins to raise interest rates, even that debt can become risky and its prices can become volatile because foreign investors experience are two shocks at the same time. Double whammy is the way we put it here, that when interest rates go up, the value of those debt securities, those bonds, goes down. But also if the local currency depreciates against the dollar because the Fed is tightening, the value of the bonds declines in the eyes of foreign investors for a second reason, and those foreign investors are apt to run for the exits. So the conclusion then is, if you have a lot of your debt is held by foreigners, you're in trouble if it's foreign currency denominated, and you can be in trouble if it's domestic currency denominated.
Yeah, actually, I read a study showing that even the ECB influences global interest rates because these big central banks have implication globally. But as we talk about a poster child for regular problems, Argentina, I'm sure Argentina shows up in your book as well. Why is Argentina not making the best out of public debt, but is always running into regular crisis?
Well, we show in the book more generally that countries with polarized politics, polarized political systems, the government oscillates between the far left and the far right, if you will, find it hard to agree on, find it difficult to sustain sound policies over time. Both sides prefer to spend on their preferred programs before they lose office to the other side. And that's Argentina, in a nutshell, stretching back for more than a century now. Germany, and that outcome depends partly on history, and it depends partly on the structure of the electoral system. So Germany's electoral system creates incentives to form coalition governments, where parties move, most of them move toward the center of the political spectrum. And it's easier to agree on the maintenance of reasonable policies, it seems to me. So we link that history to the current electoral system and in turn link that to whether you end up with good or bad fiscal policies.
Well, now, I have to ask the question, and you can, of course, say, cut it out. I don't want the question. Because, of course, U.S. is not as polarized as the hard left and the hard right. But when I follow U.S. discussions, I have the impression that U.S. politics is also getting more and more polarized. So would this basically mean that the U.S. is down the road not such a good debtor anymore?
That is my worry. So it's indisputable that U.S. politics have become more polarized over the last 3 or 4 decades. That reflects the role of media in the United States. It reflects the way congressional district lines are drawn. So political candidates stake out more extreme positions in order to defeat their primary election opponent. And then they don't have to worry about the general election because their party dominates the local district. I think polarization here reflects the role of money in American politics. But the resulting polarization does make me more worried and skeptical about governance going forward and therefore about the country's fiscal prospects. So yes, I would be more sanguine about the future evolution of the debt in Germany than in the United States. Maybe that's been true for a while, but I think the contrast between the two countries is even more pronounced now than it has been in the past.
But coming back to Europe, then we spoke about Italy, and you basically said they have to do reforms and should grow faster. I have to admit I'm a bit skeptical, but I think we agree on the goal. I'm probably skeptical that it can be achieved, but we can at least try. And others say, well, you know, it's simply we should just do a debt restructuring. It comes to the second option as well. The first option would be we should do a debt restructuring in Italy, and if you look into at the private wealth of the private Italians, you could say, well, they are rich enough. You know, to talk with Thomas Piketty, it's just a problem of the wrong distribution of wealth between the public and the private sector.
Well, we show in the book that domestic debt restructurings are few and far between because the bondholders, if you will, are a political constituency. They're often a powerful political constituency. So one does see debt restructurings, domestic debt restructurings, occasionally in history. But when government and society is unable to agree on another way to bring the debt under control, more typically what you get is hidden, invisible debt restructuring in the form of a big inflationary surprise that reduces the real value of the debt. So for a member of the Eurozone, that big inflationary surprise is not viable. For a country like Italy, where a lot of the debt is held not only by the wealthy, but by insurance companies and pension funds and the like, I think domestic debt restructuring is unlikely. Recall the case of Greece. That was an extreme case of an unsustainable debt. And ultimately, that debt was restructured. But it took 3 years of chaos to get there and produced a very deep recession in the interim.
Yeah. So no one wants a deep recession. So basically, no debt restructuring. I got it. The other point is the idea of pooling the debt. People say, you know, we have a transfer union, and so German taxpayers help Italian taxpayers to pay for the government debt. It's not really popular. Have there been any examples in this regard, and what's your view of such a strategy?
Well, probably the best example of this would be the 13 U.S. states after our War of Independence with the British. So Alexander Hamilton famously in 1790 got the Congress to agree to pool the debts of the 13 states, which had all issued their own obligations in the course of fighting the English 20 years earlier. So it can be done, but those political circumstances were distinctive, unusual. So we saw something similar in Europe in 2020, right? An exceptional circumstance called COVID-19 led European countries to agree to permit the European Union to issue 750 billion euros worth of bonds that were pooled. They were obligations of the member states collectively. So I think this, it's pretty clear the member states will agree to this. Germany will agree to it only on a limited basis in response to truly exceptional circumstances. So I have lots of academic colleagues, lots of academic friends who imagine a world in which the debts of Euro area countries are pooled. I think I know enough about European politics to understand that in reality, that's not going to happen. And what the best we can hope for along those lines, the most we can hope for along those lines, is that the decision in 2020 to issue 750 billion euros worth of joint and several bonds will be built on through series of modest additional EU issuance. But transferring Italian government debt to the European Union, clearly there's no appetite for that.
Just help me on American history, because I remember Hamilton doing this, but I also read somewhere that a few years later, some of the states were again in huge debt and needed a second bailout. And after that, they were helped, but then there was a no bailout rule. So my understanding today is that Washington is not going to help California in case California is in trouble.
Well, I don't know about today, but yes, your recollection of American history is basically correct, that states began to borrow again, mainly starting in the 1820s and 1830s, in order to build railroads and capitalize banks that would lend to farmers. And some of them overborrowed. Agricultural prices declined in the late 1830s, and a number of state governments defaulted on their debts. So there wasn't a second federal assumption of state debts. And in response to that unhappy experience, and partly in order to be able to borrow again in emergencies, states passed balanced budget laws or balanced budget constitutional amendments, not unlike the Black Zero rule in Germany. And those rules are still in place.
My understanding was that California had a few years back financing problems. And what I learned about Illinois was also that Illinois has deficits. So they have rules, but they don't stick to the rules?
No, California had to impose significant spending cuts in response to the global financial crisis and the recession that followed it. So public employees, including employees of the University of California, saw their salaries cut in response to that. States like California also have some flexibility because they have rainy day funds. So we've accumulated a large surplus that we invest that can be drawn down if there's a revenue shortfall. What you describe in Illinois is the prospective problem that may materialize in the not too distant future, where pension liabilities come due, where pension payments promised to retired state employees stretch the budget to such an extent that the state can't pay. We've had experiences in places like Orange County, California, where they invested their tax revenues imprudently. The investments went bust, and the county had to default, in effect, didn't get bailed out by the state or the feds.
Which, in my view, is correct. If you speculate or if you do poor investments, you should also take the risks. On the defense of public debt, I listened to your example of the American states as that they were supporting farmers, and mainly they were supporting the build of railroads. So I'm sure at the time being, people were saying that's a good purpose. That's good to grow the economy, whatever. So how do we define what is good public spending which justifies deficits?
We show lots of examples in the book of public investments that didn't pay off. They tried to build a canal across the isthmus connecting the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans across Honduras in the 1860s, and they're still trying to finish that link today, Honduras having gone into default on its borrowing several times in the interim. So it's tempting just to say good public debt is in the eye of the beholder, but I think we can do better than that. So there are a number of countries ranging from the Netherlands to Chile that have independent fiscal agencies, experts who are independent from politics and evaluate investment projects, the sustainability of debt. No one can know for sure what the rate of return on an investment will be. So we don't know the rate of return on public investments. And when companies invest, we don't know for sure the rate of return that will be realized on those investments. But if qualified experts enjoy insulation from independence from politics, we have to rely on their judgments and ideally operate on the basis of their judgments.
Actually, funny enough, in Germany we have something similar. We've got the so-called Bundesrechnungshof. Unfortunately, they do lots of calculations, but politicians are not really listening to them. So I know in the Netherlands it's different. I think they do even evaluate election campaign programs and speak about the financial implications. And you're nodding. That's good. So basically, your book, In Defense of Public Debt, is more like In Defense of Better Public Management.
Yeah. So the title of the book, you can blame the title of the book on me. But I think a book that was called In Defense of Prudent Public Debt Management, or a book that had been entitled A Balanced Analysis of Public Debt, probably wouldn't have attracted the same attention.
That's a good point. It's a fair point. I know how to sell books. That's not my point. So in Europe, you know, when we now have the discussion, we should take on joint debt, not only to have a better military, but mainly also to support the transformation in relation to the climate challenge. So this would be a case around a good purpose for more public debt.
Well, let me say two things about that. Number one, if the German chancellor says we need to quickly ramp up military spending in order to meet this geopolitical emergency, then yes, the spending has to be ramped up more quickly than revenues will grow. But then after the immediate emergency has passed and the adjustment has been made, it's quite correct to have a discussion of whether to pay that debt down, to retire that debt through surpluses. Second point would be the case of climate change abatement investments. Should investment in green technology and the green transition be financed by issuing debt, or alternatively be financed out of current revenues? If it's kind of a one-time investment now, and then the transition is more or less complete, then again, just like military spending, there may be an argument for financing it now by issuing a debt and then having that discussion about whether to retire, pay down the debt subsequently. if you think our societies are going to be investing in fighting climate change every year for the foreseeable future, then we have to finance it out of current revenues because it's not a one-time investment. And the other thing to think about is the rate of return on that investment. So if you think it will pay for itself, economies that invest in climate change abatement might become the green technology leaders and be able to export their way to higher incomes, or that something along those lines, that the rate of return will be high, then it makes more sense to issue debt, which will be easily serviced and retired by that larger economy out of the revenues generated by that larger economy. But if you think that these investments are socially necessary but might not have a high payoff in terms of economic growth, then taxes are going to have to be raised, or other forms of spending are going to have to be cut in order to pay for them.
In a certain sense, what we are discussing is what kind of share of the GDP goes to the government. And either it goes to the government in the current year, or it goes to the government over time, when the government takes on a credit. Did you also have a view around what the, I don't know, reasonable size for the government sector is?
No. I think that's for every country to decide. One thing that I think we know from economic studies, there's an economic historian at the University of California, Davis, Peter Lindert, who's done a lot of work on this, is that there is no association, no strong association between the size of government or the size of the welfare state on the one hand, and the health of the economy, the rate of growth of the economy on the other. That different societies make different choices, and for various reasons, some are able to reconcile large government with successful economic growth, others less so. Part of the answer is how you raise those revenues in efficient, non-distortive ways, or in ways that handicap efforts to grow. And part of the answer is in terms of what that big government is spending on. Our governments have a tendency to spend, in my view, and in Professor Lindert's view, too little on the young, too little on preschool and education and so forth, which translates into more productive workers and faster growth going forward, and too much on the old. As one of the older people at this point in my life, I'm free to say that. Pensioners vote and infants do not. So that it's not simply the size of government, but what exactly government does.
I think, first of all, a violent agreement, and in Germany it's the same. As you can see, for example, that pensions are not touched, or so we all know that the pension system doesn't work this way. So, but you would basically say, if you want to have more social transfers, out of taxes. If we want to have a continuous investment in order to fight climate change, out of taxes. If we want to invest more into education of kids, of children, probably we could even take it on a credit, because it's kind of an investment which raises future income.
That would be basically be my view. So we had a debate in the U.S. last year. It's still going on about President Biden's Build Back Better plan program and whether we could afford to incur additional public debt in order to finance it. Senator Joe Manchin from West Virginia said, no, we have too much debt already. And others of us said that portion of this program that will fund early childhood education and other growth positive programs can prudently be debt financed. So far, Senator Manchin is winning.
Professor Eichengreen, this was a great conversation. I think probably on Europe, I heard you. I fear that the politicians are going to be more inclined to put more on credit, especially in these days, as we have, you know, rising energy costs and so on. And they secretly hope for the inflation solution.
Well, let's have another podcast in a year or two, and we'll see where we're at.
Would be a great pleasure. Thanks so much. And, well, have a nice day in California.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for tuning in today. I hope you enjoyed the conversation. Please check from time to time again in the future on my channel Beyond the Obvious, because also in the future I will have the pleasure of having English language conversation with renowned economists from all over the world. Thanks for today. Have a great time. I'm Daniel Stelter.
BTO, Beyond the Obvious 2.0.